Success in life depends on not just absorbing information and regurgitating it in some ways, but it also depends on what new things you're adding.
This is the Indianist Podcast, stories of success from leaders and changemakers of Indian origin. Why have Indians achieved success across so many different disciplines around the globe? I have no idea, but let's find out together, because every story is so unique and rich. I'm so very excited to have Dr. Ruchir Puri with us today. He's the chief scientist of IBM Research, an IBM fellow, and vice president of IBM Corporate Technology. He led IBM Watson as its chief technology officer and chief architect from 2016 to 2019, and has held various technical research and engineering leadership roles across IBM's AI and research businesses. I invited him on this show as I was fascinated to learn about his journey from NIT Kurukshetra to leading IBM research. Welcome, Ruchir. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on our podcast.
Hey, thank you, Sanjay. It's a pleasure to be here and talking to your audience, and should be an exciting discussion.
Yeah, Ruchir, to give you some perspective, we have a global audience, people largely from the Indian diaspora, but also not from the Indian diaspora, who are curious about learning about the secret sauce that people like you have. As they say, to find out about the secret sauce, as we say, we need to go to the very beginning. And the very beginning means tell our listeners, where were you born, and tell us a little bit about your parents and your siblings, Ruchir.
Certainly. So I was born in Kanpur, UP in India. My mother was sort of traveling through Kanpur and to going to Patna, actually, where her father was at that time, back in the days. And I just arrived a little bit earlier than what was scheduled. And then that happened to be Kanpur, where her brother was as well, who is a physician actually at that point. And from the point of view of both my parents were professors, they were both PhDs. And if I wouldn't have done one, then I would have been the black sheep, actually, if I may say. We were well off, but we were not rich, let's say. We come from a highly family who are mostly teachers, if I may use the word. They were professors. My mother is a PhD in zoology, and my father is a PhD in chemistry, and they were teaching in the university, and my father was chairman and professor of the chemistry department there at Kurukshetra. He's originally from Allahabad, Gorakhpur area. Before partition, my dad's family moved from the areas near the border over on the UP side. So that occurred not during partition, but slightly before, when my grandfather actually moved over. And we have a family that's highly focused on education. I have one sister, so it's me and my sister, and she's here in, actually, she lives in Florida and is a CPA, actually.
Wonderful. You came early to this world, and you were born in Patna, but parents were at that time based in Kanpur, Ruchir?
My father was a young professor in chemistry at Kurukshetra University.
Yes.
And my mom, when she was pregnant with me, she was going to Patna, where her father was, my grandfather, actually. And Kanpur is on the way to Patna, actually, on the train line. And her, as I said, her brother was in Kanpur, who is a physician, actually. And so they were not based in Kanpur. They were based in, actually, Kurukshetra. But my mother happened to be traveling for the delivery to her father, actually, at that time.
Yeah,
I just happened to arrive a little bit early.
She was going to her Maika, basically.
Yeah, she was going to her Maika, exactly.
Wonderful.
Quite traditional in those days, actually.
Yes. No, that's awesome. Now, Ruchir, tell us about your early memories of being in Kurukshetra, because that early memories are very formative also from personality, from a person's character perspective, too.
My earliest memories, I would say, so being in a university sort of campus in India is in many ways a unique experience. You will find the environment, sort of the areas around you, and I'm going back to those days, relatively very clean. the obviously the people you interact with and the families who are your close friends are obviously highly educated as well, mostly children of professors. And I would say that just from my point of view, I was always the mischievous type, if I may use the word. I think my dad and more my mom always worried about, oh, he's going to get into trouble. I don't know what he's going to do. Like most mothers will worry actually about the children and their future. She worried a lot about it. And my earliest memories are certainly getting into some trouble because I wasn't being as the, like if I have two girls of my own now, and I say, if I just look back at what the things I did that troubled my mother, I say similar things will trouble my wife now as well. And so life comes full circle. But my earliest memories are, I remember playing what we used to call Pittu in those days.
Yep.
I can't find the English name for it per se. Really, Gulli Danda was another one that I was very fond of. Cricket obviously is a universal sport. Pretty much I call it a religion in India. It was always there. Those are early memories I remember. And it's very different here, but like my friends actually will come at home, and that we didn't have actually like no extensive phone networks at all in those days, and they'll come and shout my name outside my house. And my mom used to call me Tinku actually, and she'll say, and my friends used to call, at least the close friends will call me the same as well, and they'll shout my name outside, and you just come outside. And I remember telling my mom, which kind of, I think thinking now she got used to it, I'll say, I will be back. And I didn't tell her exactly where I was going. I didn't tell her, like, she knew it was a very safe environment. So she knew why. Mm-hmm. But, you know, sometimes I'll be back in hours just playing around. But like, those were very interesting days. I think the environment these days is very different. I think even in India, it is very different. Like those days are long gone. People take appointments. Like we had a wonderful sort of childhood. Very informal, if I may say, friends who were very close, free of much of electronics, if I may say, no social media. Just human touch was very prevalent everywhere. So it was wonderful, actually.
So what I gather, it was a safe environment because you were in a kind of a campus, like a little bit of a bubble, because this was your world. You didn't know what else was it, was educated people, but a lot of friend interaction, and you were a sporty kind, playing pittu, playing gulli danda, playing cricket, all of that. And did you make some good friends at that time, Richard?
Yeah, I think those friends and memories, and like many of them are here as well. Very close friends. So some of them went to sort of school with me, obviously grad school and others as well. And yes, actually friends, a lot of them in California overall, obviously many from college days here in New York and other areas as well, but absolutely, yes. And I remember like one of my very close friends here in New Jersey, actually, like we always recall, and like we went to write from our families. His father was also a professor in chemistry, and we were very close, but I think one thing we both recall, and other friends as well, that how safe the environment was. And I think you use the right word, how much of a bubble we were in, actually. We were protected from the hustle and the bustle of Sheher, as they say it, actually, in Hindi.
Yeah.
And we really protected from the business world as well. It was a very protected environment. And just how, if I may use the word, pure things were at that time, actually, not encumbered, if I may use that word, actually. So
there was no agenda, no pressure, no nothing. The only thing was friendship and fun. And so great memories of at that time, Richard.
Yes.
Now, where were you going to school during that time, Richard? Was this a school in that area itself?
Yeah, so interestingly, the university itself has a school of itself. So again, one of those bubbles where almost every kid you interacted with, their parents were university employees, let's say, but many of them professors as well. And the teachers were certainly of good caliber. Again, this was more protected environment in a university environment. The school was run by the university. There was the kind of, if I may say, safety net of an established university as well there. So teachers, certain teachers got attracted to that environment. And so I went to K-11 school there. And then those were the days when the engineering on our end used to be 5 years, as opposed to typical 4 years nowadays across the world pretty much. And there used to be only one engineering school in entire state of Haryana at that time, actually. Just one, which is, again, given by the size of India, it's like the competition used to be pretty tough overall. And like other schools, and this was one of the things where, like, this was after the school and when we went to college, actually. Because the National Institute of Technology, Kurukshetra, was the campus of the university and NIT were very close to each other. Like, they were just adjoining each other. And many of the good kids who were doing well went from there to the engineering school. And I think the other schools of IITs and others were 4 years. So either you did 12th or you went after 11th, actually. So for us, it was, if you got in, you went there, actually. And it was, from a schooling point of view, I have very close friends who have, like, we meet whenever we go to California. It's just good old times. Things have become much more complex these days.
Much, much more complex, for sure. Now, Ruchir, how were you as a student during K-12? You were mischievous, as you said, but as a student, how were you?
I would say, in the beginning, my mom had every reason to worry. I remember my dad and mom are no more, actually, but my dad saying, and I'll say some things in Hindi, and pata nahi kya kare, main professor hu, mere paas itne paise to hai nahi, mere liye business khol do, actually. Main riksha khareed sakta hu tere liye. Lekin, he'll say, Tinku, मुझे नहीं लगता तू इतना स्ट्रॉन्ग है कि रिक्शा चला पाएगा 40 डिग्री हीट में, तो तू पढ़ ले थोड़ा. एंड दिस माय डैड वाज द मोर चिल टाइप, आई वुड से, वंडरफुल ह्यूमन बीइंग, एक्चुअली, लाइक दिस, ही वुड बी मोर रिलैक्स्ड ऑन थिंग्स, एंड दैट वुड वरी मी. लाइक माय मॉम वाज मोर, लॉट मोर ड्रिवन, एंड शी रियली मेड श्योर वी डिड द स्टडीज एंड सो ऑन. एंड बट एज आई गॉट मोर इनटू, आई वुड से, हाई स्कूल, देन आई कोट अनकोट स्मार्टेंड अप, एक्चुअली. And actually, I remember I got very fond of mathematics, actually. Mm. That I started enjoying it a whole lot. There was one subject I enjoyed a whole lot, actually. And that, actually, once you pick up a more of a mathematical trend in that mind, then it picks on itself. And after that, it was fine. But I do remember my mom and dad, and I remember this story from my dad very well. मुझे नहीं लगता तू चला पाएगा 40 डिग्री हीट में, पढ़ ले थोड़ा सा.
इट्स वन ऑफ द फनीएस्ट स्टोरीज आई हैव हर्ड ऑन दिस पॉडकास्ट. रुचिर, यू सेड टू इम्पोर्टेंट थिंग्स व्हिच आर इम्पोर्टेंट टू आवर ऑडियंस. यू सेड व्हेन यू वेंट इनटू हाई स्कूल यू सडनली स्टार्टेड डूइंग वेल एंड देन यू टुक अ रियल लाइकिंग टू मैथ. कैन यू पिन पॉइंट समथिंग फॉर आवर ऑडियंस? व्हाट वाज इट? Was there a seminal event? Was there just something that came to you? Ke father ne riksha ka dar itna tha ki ab main, I don't think I'll be able to do a riksha. Let me really find a non-riksha profession. And nothing against people who are driving rikshas in our audience. I want to make sure that I don't offend any of the riksha walas here.
No, but there is probably competition is pretty tough in that area.
So in that area.
It's not an easy profession to...
Yes. Well, you probably wouldn't have been a great riksha wala anyway.
I would really say, I think, with probably, and I remember even early on, I would say, and like I had a very artistic bent of mind as well. Actually, I used to paint
really
early on, actually. And my mom says this, and I think many people know this about me. Like, I would make things a whole lot from like nothing. You may remember, and this, I'm really dating myself on this, and you may remember, like, there used to be these watercolors, six of them in this camel box. A yellow camel box with little cylinders with box, actually. And I remember I used to paint, actually, and then I'll run out of them, and I had accumulated several of them. So I remember making, like, I covered these boxes with paper I painted them red and like black dots on top to make like a train, actually. And I made with these cylinders their wheels, actually. Mm. And at the back, this is one of the, if I may say, like in the wall, there was this closet, actually, which is not living room. And then I made these at the back, I made with carbon paper, which I don't think many of people will remember now.
Yep.
People who use typewriters used to use carbon paper.
Yep.
To make copy of what you're typing.
And it would stain your fingers
and
stuff like
that. Stain your finger and so on. And with carbon paper, on the sort of the other side of the carbon paper, I made black mountains, actually.
Wow.
Holding them. And I would say I had a little bit, very early on, creative aspects. Of course, my mom didn't appreciate it as much at that time because she wanted me to get on the regular track of study. But I would say, like, I found math very logical and also creative as well from many points of view, because it offered me like a puzzle, actually, that I was looking at. And I don't remember a particular incident other than I would say there was certainly some fear of, okay, I think it is time to now smarten up. You get into high school, and after that, if you don't get into, like, I will say I was totally careless. It's enough that I couldn't care what you did. Because it was a fact that we were not rich per se.
You were comfortable, not rich.
We were comfortable. We had a very safe environment and like wonderfully loving family. But we were not rich, actually. It's not like I had my dad's business to inherit. That's fine, actually. This is not fine.
That's true.
And at some point you realize it, that you come from a, and obviously my lot of credit to my mom, I would say. She kept at it. She just kept at it to, you know, keep focused and keep motivating me, actually. I remember, actually, young kids won't relate to it these days, but I will see they were, actually. My mom, I remember, and like she will see me, like, the Parnira, like, very early on, she will actually, or something else I'm doing, I got into some trouble. So she will hold me in her, because I used to run away, actually. And she will hold me in her sort of, she'll cross her legs and hold me, actually.
Yep.
And hold my hands, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So don't flap them around. And she'll slap me a couple of times, actually. And then she will cry, actually. Crying after giving me a lesson. And I'll tell her, kind of the D type, actually, as they say in Hindi. And I'll tell her, like, if you are going to cry, then why are you actually clapping me? This doesn't make sense, actually.
Oh,
but
God.
I would say later on, I realized that I think you really have to. I was always logical.
Mm.
Like, I think I smartened up at the time I probably needed to. So I was not illogical, actually. Like, I somehow realized early on that there is some slack built into the system.
System.
You can pick up that little bit later. Now, yes. It's possible I may not have picked it up. It's possible. But somehow, it's not that I took a risk. But I was ignorant at that time, but I was able to pick that up later on, because I believe, actually, again, this is where I believe, as long as you keep on nurturing your creativity, irrespective of the modality in which you nurture that creativity, it helps you in many different dimensions. Like, I remember I was very fond of actually taking things apart. And I'll fix or put them together. Other times I won't, actually. Like, mom, these are the kind of things that, you know, I would say worried my mom a little bit. I take things apart and then I'll study them. And sometimes I got them together, like I will open up the radio, actually. I'll take a watch apart, actually. And, you know, sometimes I got it together. Other times I didn't, actually. But those were the things I would say. Those were not necessarily academic pursuits, but those were pursuits that helps your creativity a whole lot. I was always, actually, I remember this in school, I always questioned things. It was another math professor, Dr. Sharda, actually, and she, like, my mom will say, why don't you, she was right next to us, like, why don't you go and ask her some things, actually, and she'll sit down with me, and she'll teach me something, and I would say, okay, and I had a longer way of doing things, actually, and I'll present my answer to her and say, that's right, but not right, actually. And it's way too long. And I'll tell her, but it's right. What's wrong with it? Can you tell me what's wrong with this? Of course, she was trying to teach me a more efficient way, but I was always on, like, this is my way, and obviously I will be more efficient on it. Because just because it's your way and it is done something else, you are forcing me to learn that. There's nothing wrong in having another method, actually, which was my way of doing things. So I remember those things very well, because I think it wasn't just, I was always going many times against the grain, actually. That's almost inherent in me many times. So I'm not very easy to just fit in the system here, actually. Like, I'm not, usually haven't pursued the most normal path.
Ruchi, you said a couple of things that I want clarity for our audience. You said having that creative bent is really good, which you had. You were taking things apart, you were drawing with that carbon paper, etc. Why do you think that is important? Again, for this is for our listeners to know, Richard.
I would say to a certain information, like what new knowledge you are adding, what's your contribution? Actually, taking that some information and reproducing it is, we are living in the world of ChatGPT, actually. That's done easily by machines. And that has always been the case, I would say, that no, creativity is, in my mind, one of the most distinguishing traits of human beings. And yes, you know, one may say machines will get there at some point. Like, I would say one differentiates, and someone excelling at creativity can take their knowledge, skills, and apply to many different things. If you just keep to your lane, you can only do one thing. And if you sort of are more creative, you are able to bring many disciplines together and apply to many disciplines as well. So you are much more flexible in a very fast-changing environment. Because the environment around you is changing all the time. Businesses shift, new technologies come and go, and change is constant. So people who are a lot more creative are much more adaptable to change. Thereby, I would say adaption is about, you know, I would say they are the survivors, actually. They are the people who excel overall, I would say.
So being able to survive, being able to adapt, I think comes from creativeness. The other thing you said, and that's also for our audience, is that you did not fit in, so to speak. Is that a problem, or you're at this stage, you're comfortable with that? Because there are a lot of people like you, I presume you know that, who are in this audience who are saying, hey, I don't fit in. I've never fitted in, but...
I would almost say you have to manage it. You can't be like so disruptive that people throw you out, if I may say it that way. You have to figure out the battles you are going to fight, actually. Like, I didn't fit in a mold, but it wasn't like I was being disruptive or disrespectful or chaotic, actually, in many ways. I didn't fit in a mold, which is a sort of a very traditional path that people follow. They study, they go give exams, they excel at it. And I did many different things early in my school days, actually. And just as you grow, actually, into your, as you go along in your journey, I would say, not fitting in a constructive way, is a wonderful property.
Why? Just for our audience.
Because if people just fit in, then I, as a leader, would like to listen from someone a contrarian view, a well-supported, logically contrarian view. If everybody fit in and said, look, like, abided by what I'm saying or others are saying around them, which is the system as it is, then it's hard to add that new knowledge, if I may say, for that sort of overall that area. So not fitting in, of course, we can't have people, all the people not fit in, and we can't have all the people who fit in. But these two perspectives are kind of checks and balances, if I may say. I was certainly on the part of and have always been not fitting in exactly. And I don't mean it in a disruptive way, actually. I always brought a questioning, contrarian point of view into things. And as you go along with your journey, you hone your intuition more and more on, okay, this sounds right, this doesn't sound right, actually. This is just the knowledge you acquire and the experience you get.
But I think your point also was that you question, but be well supported by facts. Don't just question without just saying, okay, I'm questioning the status quo, but I don't have any basis of questioning that status quo.
Yeah. Like always, like example I gave, math professor, and she telling me that's not wrong, but that's wrong. And I questioned, like, this method is my method. I know it very well. It's fast for me. What's wrong? And it's so supported by a proof, actually. It's not like I'm just questioning. It was supported by a fact, data. And that has always been what I have appreciated in people. Don't give opinions. Opinions are like dime a dozen. Give opinions supported by facts. Because then you can argue it. People may not agree with them all the time, but at least you are on solid foundation, actually.
That is true. So, Ruchir, as time was going by, you became really interested in math and you got into really all-out mode in high school. You went into an extra gear. So what happened? You did the 11th. You didn't do the plus two, right? So what happened in 11th? How did you do? Tell our audience a little bit about that.
Those used to be the days when we didn't have a sort of nowadays this kind of entrance exam for everything. We had our what we call our PCM grades, mm-hmm. physics, mm-hmm. chemistry, math.
Yeah,
there used to be a ranking. This used to be sort of a university exam. There were like the board exam. There was ranking. There's state level boards actually, and mm-hmm. and you get your score, and the score are ranked, and you like a line is drawn. This is not like here where you write an essay and things are very subjective, actually.
Right.
And not objective as much, if I may use that. This is rhyme and reasoning to all methodologies, but
there
it was very clear. And sat 84.5%, line drawn.
Done.
Out. You are 84.49, too bad, actually. Like, go home, actually, try next year. And you got in. Actually, my grade wasn't the, I would say, highest to get. We didn't have computer science at that time, actually. We had electronics and communication engineering, which was the branch which used to be most popular. And of course, we had civil, mechanical, and electrical engineering and so on. And I got into electrical engineering. And in the first year of college, I did very well, actually. These used to be like, you know, 200 of top students. Half of them came from that state and half of them came from across India. These are national institutes, so they used to be split, actually. Mm-hmm. And all national institutes like those were split because it reserved, actually. They wanted to get students from across India. Every state had some kind of seats that they had for the schools. And among those, like 200 kids or so, I did very well, actually. And to the point, there used to be one or two kids who will change their branch to electronics and communication, and there were only 30 students in that branch at that time, which was the most popular, if I may use the word, branch. It was like computer science today, actually. And I changed it after first year, actually, because I was passionate about electronics, actually. That's something that inspired me always. Digital things inspired me always, actually. That's, I remember, as I told you, actually, I remember taking digital clocks apart even before I got into sort of engineering school. So there I studied computer architecture. I remember in my senior sort of project, I built a robot. I still have that thesis, actually. And we designed a printed circuit board by hand. We built it by hand from scratch. We programmed a microprocessor. We collaborated with the mechanical engineering department to build a robot. This is, I'm talking 1987. And we were building robotics at that time, actually. And this is like
unbelievable.
Really wonderful time I had, actually.
Wow. So you were building robotics in 87. You were doing PCB boards there. Do you think when you went there, you found out that this was your calling, so to speak? You had found what you were good at?
I just loved engineering. Many people who know me know I'm like, I can't see myself in any other profession than like engineering. I love hands-on work. Most people here know I code on a regular basis, despite all the responsibilities you get. Mm-hmm. I just don't want to be a person who talks about things without knowing them. Let me say it that way. I don't want to be.
Yeah.
I want to talk about things that I know about. Otherwise, let other people talk. It's fine. It's good, actually. Like, people know should talk. And of course, you have to communicate well as well. I don't mean actually that, no, you can just, if you're just an expert and if you don't communicate, you shouldn't. There's a role for everyone. But yes, that was certainly my calling, actually, on I loved, as I said, our first year of actually, this was since 5 years, and we used to have these workshops actually, like doing smithy, carpentry. We did lathe, through which we built really complex heavy iron things actually. We used to have electrical engineering labs, and I just, that kind of stuff, I loved it. So it wasn't just about math. I loved connecting theory to practice. I want to understand theory, but I really want to do practice. That was what I just loved, actually. And I think, and it really came from, as we were discussing earlier, from my time, this sort of creative activities, because it gave venue to me to be more creative, actually, in almost a formal education way. That it allows you, it taught you skills and gave you knowledge through which you can build things to impact the world, actually. That you can just play around and not formally impact the world. That gave me the tools and the mechanism through which you can impact the world. And again, I was not philosophical that I had to literally change the world and so on, but it just gave me innate joy, actually.
Yeah.
Which again, I was being, it made me happy, actually.
So, Richard, two things from what you said, again, for our audience. Did you get into electronics because of your certain grade, or did you yourself know that this is what I want to do? Because some people spend their whole life not finding their innate joy, which you did. And this is very important for them to know. How did you get into it? Was it an accident or luck?
No, I would say for me, I was always curious about sort of things that are quote-unquote electronics.
Mm.
We used to have this radio called Pi Radio, actually, way back when. And I took it apart. I take its speakers, woofers, connected to different things. This is school days. I had a matka in which I'll put a speaker and some wool, and I'll look at acoustics and all kind of stuff. As I said, so I was always very fond of, if I may say, electronics things and building them and taking them apart and so on. And so the creative aspects connected there quite well. And even when I got into sort of the school, the college, engineering school, I got into electrical engineering, but because my passion was on electronic side so much, I just wanted to get there. Now, obviously, it was, you needed to be in top 15% of the kids at the entrance to get there. I wasn't there, just from a grade point of view yet. But I made it a point there, and out of 200 students, I was third, actually. So first, second, third, I was third ranked, actually, consistently. And of course, that enabled me, and the top two students were already in electronics branch. Okay, that allowed you to just say, okay, there is an opening there, so you can go. And I had my eyes set on it right from the very beginning, actually. Wow. There were very few students who changed branches. I think I'm the only one who did actually to that particular branch of engineering, electronics and communications. And again, I think to answer your question precisely, no, I knew actually. Because I'd been playing with it a whole lot. It's not like I knew because of the salaries were high, or that didn't even play in my mind at all. It just was like I was playing with this stuff enough, actually. And maybe that was part of the reason I could argue I would have done better in the grade, from a grades point of view, even earlier, had I not been devoting so much of time having fun with these things, actually. So it kind of sort of comes back to you in terms of, and I would say that has benefited me a whole lot in terms of that creativity, connecting threads, being very hands-on and so on.
You said something else, Richard, about being hands-on. You said you still code people who know you. You still like to do things. And you said that's very important. You're not just talking about things. Why is that important for our audience to know? There are people who just can talk from theory, but you actually have probably coded in C or Lisp or Prolog or any of these other languages.
Coded in assembly, built something, what is known as Norton Utility way back when. Basic, I like a lot of languages. C++, Java, Python, you name it. Right. In any case, I believe, we are in an era driven by technology. Technology changes amazingly fast. More so than at any other time, techies must know the sort of the technical underpinnings behind things. And the only way to know technical underpinnings is to practice it. That's the only way to know, actually. Because nobody can, this is not about theory as much. I think things are becoming very practical. Physics can be theory, actually. Engineering is not theory, per se. You need some theoretical background. But engineering, by its very nature, is a practical discipline. Engineering is an applied discipline, actually. You apply knowledge of physics, mathematics, chemistry, and other things to it. But you are building things. And building things, physics only captures some sort of, if I may say, pure things. Try implementing things, world isn't pure, actually. You know, you build physical models or physical equations, but they ignore many things regarding, well, the friction is this way. You can assume the surface is frictionless. Well, the surface is not frictionless, actually. Surface has very non-uniform friction. Start playing these things and it should go here, but it goes like the robot we are trying to build. It should go here, but it goes here because the surface we have is like the cement surface with all kinds of potholes in it. And like, there's no way to model it. There's no way to model it, actually. You're going to need a supercomputer to model these kind of things. The real world is very, very complex. And that's why I say, okay, do things kind of come from an experience point of view into this because you're an engineer, actually. Now, if you're a theoretician or something, you can prove things mathematically. I got it. But like, you are an engineer and engineers build things. And you should be talking from your experience rather than it should be so. And like the one thing I just don't, I would never want to end up there is like talking when you don't have a good idea, actually. You can read about it and talk some buzzwords. I'm not saying that's right or wrong. It's just, it doesn't make me happy. It just does not make me happy. Yeah.
Now, some of our leaders say that they, when they get to a certain level, they get meetinged out. They go from meeting to meeting, and there's not enough time to do the hands-on stuff that they used to do. Any suggestions for them?
I would say similar will hold true for me, but it's to a slightly lesser extent. Almost everyone knows, actually, many of the Fridays afternoons, I reserve it for myself. I would read over the weekend. And to me, it's not that I haven't gotten like just my titles and other things. So obviously, meetings get slapped onto it. But many times, I would say, you are known by the credibility you have. And that credibility is a technical credibility, actually. People value your opinion because you're technically good. And if you lose that, then obviously over time, you're going to lose what makes you credible as well. And I've always taken that to heart, actually. Just know what your skills are, what you excel at, and keep true at it. It's almost like a business. Keep true to your core strengths. Realize what your core strengths are and fight on them. Versus, oh, that area is growing. Let me go there. And many times businesses will fail on that because that's not their core strength, actually. And then they stumble and they fail on it and all the money that you invested in it goes down as well. Like I knew my strengths always. My strength comes from my technical underpinnings. So I prioritize it in many ways. I'll even on the meetings and other things, I'll say, I don't think I need to be there. Like I know you need a title, but I don't think I need to be there. Someone else should cover it. Of course, many times I'm forced as well just because you have certain titles, so you need to go some places. So it's not like I'm not victim of that meeting overload, but I've tried my best to keep it in check because you need to continue to hone your core strengths and fight from them rather than become someone else that you are not innately.
So hone your core strengths. I think that's a great message and fight from there and don't give up that. Ruchir, let's just go back to the engineering days because you did exceptionally well because you're in 87, 88, you were doing robots, PCBs. What happened at the end of that? You were getting ready to graduate. How did you do?
I'm ready, getting ready to graduate. And there weren't many people who were going out for education. And like at that point, I said, I think I should go and get some. I remember, so there used to be this company called Semiconductor Complex Limited in Chandigarh. The only semiconductor fab in India. The only one, actually. Which later on got burnt down as well and got rebuilt, actually. This was in Mohali, actually. And like they had a test and written test and this and that, and I did fine, actually. So I got selected for the job. And I remember actually going to this fab, and this was a clean room, actually. As you know, semiconductor chips need a clean room. And now, given the environment in India at that time, the clean room is like spick and span, AC inside. It's like a wonderful environment. It's like, I think I can do that. This is a nice working place. It's like kind of a posh environment, if I may say. This is nice. Then I said, I think I need to learn more, actually. Like, I read more. So I gave this exam called Graduate Aptitude Entrance Test. And actually, this was... So I went to IIT Kanpur for my master's.
After that, you went to IIT Kanpur.
Yeah, then I went to IIT Kanpur, and then I did my master's over there. And in actually, interestingly, in microelectronics and electrical engineering.
Wow.
I continued my journey on electronics.
But why did you do master's? Did you want to learn more? What was the motive behind that?
The reason was, if you were in an IIT at that time, there was a lot of students were going out, actually. So you had kind of a mentors who were going out. You knew how to fill the applications and so on. Like, no, at NIT, we didn't have that many people going for grad education outside at that moment. Most of the students go get a job. They did, like, I would say many of my classmates have done, like, incredibly amazingly, actually, in businesses and so on. That was the path people were on. It was not normal for people to go for kind of higher education. And which was, I think, in IITs, it definitely was different at that time and is different now as well. And so I went to Kanpur, actually, and my mother's side, actually, my grandfather was in Kanpur at that time as well. But so there I did microelectronics and electrical engineering. And my project was actually on designing software to design chips, actually. So that's where I picked up software, actually.
Oh, really?
And I took a lot of computer science classes on natural language processing. That was my first class at that time at Kanpur. I took classes in computer architecture and so on. And from there, I went to Alberta in Canada, did computer engineering, and then in PhD. And I had a phenomenal time, actually, and joined IBM Research, actually.
So going from the engineering college to IIT, was that a big transition for you?
It was a wonderful learning environment because the caliber of the people coming in, they were coming in from all over India, but they were all very academically oriented at that. By then, I had become quite good at academics and cracking this stuff as well. And again, I think my passion continues to be in software, sort of electronics and software at that time. And I was given the opportunity to truly hone it, actually. Even in undergrad, actually, at NIT, I remember doing an internship once in this company, actually, which to make scooters, actually, called Loya Machines, actually. And I did software for them, actually. So I was one of the very few kids across my entire undergrad class who was doing software at that early a time when most people aren't, actually. I had one of my friends, his uncle came from Ohio, actually, at that time, and he bought a Atari computer, actually. A friend of mine who was with me in college, he was from, actually, MP, Madhya Pradesh. He didn't have, actually, a screen. We had a TV, and he didn't have this to hook up to. So we were very close, so he gave it to me. And I will play with it, and I connected it. So I had access to a computer probably very early on, that not because I bought it or we could afford it, because this friend of mine whose uncle came from Ohio got him an Atari computer that he didn't know what to do with, and he gave it to me, actually. I had this desire and passion very early on, and I was able to hone it and further it at Kanpur, which was a wonderful learning environment. Like, I went back recently, like I would say three years back, where I've been blessed and lucky to be recognized as a distinguished alumni from IIT Kanpur.
Congratulations.
Your luminaries there are just awesome, actually. Our CEO, Arvind Krishna, who is also like 2 years back before I was, he was recognized as well. And I was telling this to Arvind that this is like such a wonderful thing. Because you go to your alma mater and like the halls you took lectures in, and I wouldn't say it was a step change, but the caliber of people was very high. The professors were amazing as well. It's a very, again, a bubble. I would certainly call it a bubble.
Yeah. But
it was a wonderful environment. And I did well there as well. And there I continued to grad school and then my journey at IBM.
And why did you pick Alberta for grad school, Rucha?
I would really say I was actually going to be in Minnesota. My advisor had some visa issues and so on. He actually happened to move and I went there with him actually just for admission time. He was actually good in the area that I was going to do my grad school in. And it was a wonderful choice actually for me because actually another thing I love is nature. I just love nature actually overall. I can go and hike by myself for days actually.
So Alberta was just God sent for you.
Yeah, it's like such a beautiful place actually.
Yes.
It's like turquoise blue lakes and snow-capped mountains and this was just amazing actually. So,
yeah, that's incredible. Rucha, we talk about some inflection points of people's lives that would have made a big impact. And obviously, your journey is still continuing. We'll talk about that. Was going to IIT or coming to Alberta because your professor had visa issues, would you consider either one of those key inflection points in your life?
I would certainly say if there's an inflection point in my life, it'll be like the biggest one will be coming to IBM Research. That is truly an inflection point because it was, to me, this was, and this is, I'm talking about 1994-95 actually. This was the place where like massive innovations were happening actually. This is like heydays of IBM and like people here were like, I used to read books about them. There were 6 Nobel Prize winners in this building, 6 Turing Award winners, which is kind of Nobel Prize of computer science.
Of course.
And like you look at this, I don't know if you know about like fractals and Mendelbrot was here and people who invented actually entire areas. Bob Dennard, who invented memory, was here. Like people who invented databases, computer programming languages. And to me, this was the temple of technology at that time. And like just to be able to work in that environment and you know, that was your first break that you got. There's actually a wall in here when you walk into IBM Thomas J. Watson Research Center. They used to have this wall actually where they have pictures of all IBM fellows actually until that point. And you look at that wall and you're like in awe actually, literally in awe that you're in the middle of gods actually. You're in a temple. To me, that was, I would say, the pivotal point in my journey. And it's been almost, I would say, 29 years and counting for me. This was, I usually say it, I don't call it work. You get paid to have fun. It's not work. Work is fun. And like I usually say it, I wouldn't go and change anything. I'm lucky, blessed in every possible way. From a professional point of view and personal as well. I've like wonderful, loving wife and 2 wonderful daughters. Both of them are in college and one just graduated college and went to grad school now.
So how did you get into IBM after Alberta? Because you said that was obviously a key inflection point.
Yeah, interestingly, I was doing a bridge gap actually once you graduate a couple of months at this place in Ottawa called Bell Northern Research. There was a company called, it was, think of it as Bell Labs Northern Arm, actually, if I may say. And there was a person here who was doing a postdoc, but was going to look for a job somewhere else because there wasn't a permanent position available. So he sent me his resume and I was looking at a position and I knew about Thomas J. Watson Research Center. And I said, while you are at it, I circulate your resume here. Why don't you take my resume and circulate? As well. I got an interview call and I interviewed and it went amazingly well. And this used to be like 2 days interview process. It was like, I loved the people. And this was the place where, in my specialization area in grad school, I studied algorithms for basically the application area where I applied algorithms is for chip design. These chips are made with literally billions of transistors, hundreds of billions by now. Nobody can design them by hand. They're designed with software, like highly specialized optimization software, which is what I did, which is a perfect combination of mathematics and practice. Mm-hmm. Electrical engineering, computer science, mathematics, and practice. And I'm like, that's the area I just loved. I came here and I applied that area and people who were like chief editors of top journals in that area were here, actually. And I was just lucky to be. Everything that has been invented in that area for software, for chip design, was done in this building, actually, in which I'm lucky to work still.
Wow.
It's just awesome, actually, to be here. And that's why I called that particular moment out, like, turning point. Because I think if that wasn't the turn I took, I'll do fine, actually. It's not like I won't do fine. But just, like, my innate curiosity and creativity wouldn't have been fed. Even a fraction of what it has been, because just me being here and, like, the wonderful set of people that exist. Just the brilliance of it, actually, is awesome.
Wow.
That's fantastic. Ruchir, when you left India, were your parents in favor of that? You were leaving the country. What did mom and dad have to say?
Yeah, so I think because both my mom and dad came, obviously, they were professors themselves. So they were certainly in favor of go get more educated.
More educated.
And obviously, if you want to go for a PhD and something, like, the environment wasn't very conducive to that in engineering area in India at that time.
Right.
I spent some time at Indian Institute of Science as well, actually. Like, I did an internship there. And yeah, that was a good place, but there were better places available and good professors available outside. And my dad always encouraged that it'll give you a different perspective in life, if nothing else. It'll broaden you a whole lot. So yeah, they were certainly in favor. My mom, obviously, and, like, it's not that she would have preferred, but, like, she was, I think my mom was my biggest fan, if I may say, actually. She scolded me a whole lot, but was also my biggest fan, actually, I would say. She was sad, but sad in ways a mom will be, actually. You want your children close by, you can see them, but that way. So, no, I did not face a resistance from going out.
That's true. Ruchir, you obviously have had just enormous success, engineering, IBM, etc. Has your definition of success changed over time? I mean, when you were starting out, you probably were looking for a job or a PhD or things like that.
Definitely. I think that would happen with almost anyone as you mature. Like, my definition of success was never money. Interesting. Never money. That was not something that sort of, I think I say it with all honesty, lack of money can make you unhappy. More of money will not make you happy. Yeah, you need certain amount to be comfortable.
Comfortable.
But just because you have more doesn't make you happy, actually. Because if a number makes you happy, by definition, you'll be unhappy. Because someone has more than you. If that's what you're watching out for, you are in trouble already, actually. And again, I think my definition of success has always remained in some ways constant, which is about just do things that kind of make you happy. And if you're happy, you're successful. That's my success has never, my measure has never been either degrees or this or that. I think, okay, that's fine. Yes, that's the way at which world looks at it. And I'm saying this with all honesty, actually. It's good to be comfortable with yourself. That's most important, actually. And then, obviously, to be able to contribute knowledge. For me, the success metric was for me to be able to contribute to a body of knowledge in the discipline I practiced. That was important to me. Very important to me that you have the credibility in that area, you are known in the area, people recognize in that area. And that's what made me happy. That's what I'm saying, actually. That for me, the success metric was recognition by the community of your skills, a respect by the community, and your innate happiness that you contributed to the world, actually, in this discipline. Yeah. To me, that was a measure of success. And in addition, have a moral compass, if I may say, actually. I always kept that moral compass with me, always, actually. We'll do it in a way that is ethical, that's moral, and that's it. And partly that came from my sort of family's education background.
Yeah.
That, okay, do no hanky-panky, just do straight. There is a path through it. If you are honest to yourself, there is a path through it.
So as you said, success is defined by your contribution to the things that you enjoy are of value to you. Ruchir, all our guests talk about the role of mentors in their life. Mentors come in many shapes, sizes, parents, grandparents, teachers, colleagues, etc. Have they played any role in your life at all?
Oh, absolutely. I would say like every person who is successful by whatever metrics someone chooses is supported by standing on shoulders of others. For sure. And I was no different. I would say if I go very early on, despite me not realizing it at that time, my mom was my mentor for sure. Like she was the one who was guiding light. And you don't realize it that early on in your life, actually. But like now that you are more experienced, a little bit wiser, probably you realize it more. And then I think in college days, there's a professor, actually, Dr. K.K. Agrawal. He was certainly an outstanding mentor who encouraged me to really, I think your nature matches doing further studies. You should, actually. And then I think from, I would say, grad school onwards, my mentors here have been, so the colleague of mine here, Louise Trevelyan, actually, she's like incredibly smart and brilliant. She's been my mentor. People, like another sort of a engineer friend of mine, John Cohn, is like amazingly hands-on, truly brilliant person. He's been my mentor. And then, of course, you have, if I may say, your virtual idols, if I may say. They guide you because you read about them and you know about their life and so on. And they're not mentor that you talk to everyday basis, but they are kind of your guiding lights, if I'm that way. Sort of have had several, but I would say the other one, my wife herself, she's a physician actually. She is definitely she's incredibly smart and has, if I may say, more years of education than I do. Given she's medicine and she came here and she gave all the exams, went to residency and so on. And I think we would both argue we are mentors to each other, definitely. So I think I'm blessed and lucky in many different ways, actually. So
wide variety of mentors and people should look out for them is what your message is to our audience.
Absolutely. And I think sometimes they come in forms you don't realize that. And typically I look at mentor relationship as a give and take. Never one way. Successful mentorships are never one way.
Why do you say that?
And they are learning something from you as well. Irrespective of what position you are at, you had to have your unique path as well into this.
Ruchir, you had a great journey, 29 plus years at IBM, etc. Where do you see your journey going from here? You still have a long, beautiful journey ahead. And it's hard in this world to predict, but if you were to take a guess, or if I were to put in ChatGPT, where do I see Ruchir's journey? What do you think will ChatGPT or Llama or any of these things spit out?
So interestingly, I'm lucky to work in a place where Bob Denner worked, the guy who invented the memory and discovered semiconductor scaling laws. And like people, like he just quote-unquote retired, he's still a fellow emeritus after 50 years.
Wow.
Like he will come just brilliant, just raw brilliance, actually. And like you're just lucky to work in a place where age is not seen as long as you are contributing and, you know, you're having fun. And one thing I think a lot of people know about me, I have very high energy. My wife worries about that energy, actually. Like, you are always like...
You're on,
actually. Like, literally, she says, I can wake you up, Ruchir, at night, and you will say, yes. It's like, you are never off. And that's what she worries about. As a physician, she worries about it. But I have a very high energy, actually. And I find too many things very exciting. Again, I think we'll be with the fingers crossed, with good health. I'll continue as long as I'm a good contributor to this community. And the day I stop being that, I actually tell it to my senior vice president, Dario, you should fire me that day, actually. This, like, I do not want to be, like, if I am somehow not in my right senses, that I'm still here when I'm not in that high energy mode, then I think you should, that means I'm not in my senses, actually. You just fire me that day. It's just, I don't want to be in a situation where Like, I just want to continue to work and contribute. And the day I'm not, I don't need to work, quote unquote, for a paycheck. Many people in my position or others have reached that stage, but we are working because we are making an impact, defining a strategy, defining direction of a massive company, like an iconic company like IBM, actually. It was 112 years old.
Wow.
That means a lot, actually. And I take that responsibility very seriously. Yeah.
Good. We took you in the future. Now, maybe we'll take you back for a second. What advice would you give to Ruchir, who's just graduating out of IIT with a master's degree? If you were to just tell him one or two things, looking back. This is also for our audience, by the way.
One thing I actually, when they make you an IBM fellow, which is the highest technical honor that someone can get, actually, and they're like, in IBM's history of 112 years, we have only had 380 odd fellows, actually. Our iconic sort of history overall. And then when they make you a fellow, they pass you a similar question. And there's an interview, and they're not a formal interview. Like, when after you have made a fellow, they could what advice and so on. And I only give one advice to everyone. And I never articulated it that well until later in my life. So I come from Kurukshetra, actually, which is many people in India know this land of Mahabharata, actually, where Lord Krishna gave the famous sermon of Gita. And the most famous sort of verse from or shloka from Gita is, and I never internalized it as much in the beginning. I was always on that path, actually. But get some principles in life and just stick to them. And to me, and I say this now, I'm responsible for all the technical executives and leaderships and so on in this company. And I always tell them, like, when people come to me and say, like, when will I be a distinguished engineer? And I say, I think that's the wrong question to ask. Trust me, if you do the work, there's someone out there who is watching out. But if you do the work with all honesty, you will be fine, actually. And just focus on the work. Don't worry about what will happen. And I don't think in Gita it meant don't look forward to the result. It just meant don't get deviated by what will happen in the results, actually. That's what that sort of shloka actually means. So that means if you're worrying about the results, your focus is not entirely on the job itself. And to me, I would, like, if I just tell this to my younger self, I will probably internalize this a lot more earlier in my life, actually. It's not that I always had that principle, but I only articulated it much better later in my life. And I would just tell this to every techie. Karmanyavadikaraste mafaleshu kadashna.
Very well, sir. Focus on your work or your deeds, as they say.
Yeah, as they say, focus on your work / deeds and the rest will be fine. Actually, be truthful to yourself, have a moral compass, you'll be fine.
Great. Ruchir, just in closing, very brief lightning round of questions, just one or two sentences. Our podcast is called Indianness. What is your definition of Indianness?
Yeah, my definition of Indianness is, so I'm a Hindu, and Hinduism is not, quote unquote, a hard religion. It's a philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And my definition of Indianness is really follow the philosophy of, and in my case, again, I'm a spiritual person, Hinduism. And I think it's a wonderful philosophy. And every religion has a philosophy. So I'm not about it's not about a particular religion. Follow a philosophy in life. And to me, Indianness is about following that philosophy that our culture and history has taught us.
Right. Follow your philosophy. Ruchir, who has been the one most influential person in your journey? One, not two. And I have a feeling I know the answer, but let's see what your answer is.
I would say my mother.
I knew that. Ruchir, final question. Nike's tagline is just do it. If Ruchir had to have a tagline, what would that be?
Again, I think I just said it. Karmanyavadikaraste mafaleshu kadashna.
I knew you would say that. Ruchir, thank you so much. I could go on for hours because there's so many other things I wanted to know. I didn't get a chance to talk about your sibling. I wanted to know a little bit more about your parents, their journey a little bit, but maybe we'll have you back again. But What a fascinating journey, and what a humility. Thank you for the time and for what you do. It's been a true pleasure.
Thank you, Sanjay. I think this was a wonderful conversation. I can say it with all honesty. I truly enjoyed it.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Indianist Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a 5-star review and subscribe to enjoy future inspirational stories.